Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Author Joe Wilkins has said his new novel is very much about where he grew up in eastern Montana, but also about how our environment shapes us and the people around us. Consider the perspective of an abandoned young person who finds himself alone on the prairie. Joe shares this journey with his readers and us.
Joe, welcome back to Resounds. You are such a prolific writer. I think we had you here a couple months ago with Corey Williamson doing poetry. But you have this incredible new novel, The Entire Sky, and what an emotional roller coaster that was for me. Just so real and so sad and maybe a little bit of hope, but tell the listeners something about The Entire Sky, the theme, really, of that novel.
Yeah. Well, it's great to be back here on Resounds. I loved our conversation with Corey. That was fantastic. And I'm really happy to be talking about The Entire Sky, which is a book that I began in the middle of the pandemic when we felt so far from one another. And I'd been working on another book that was kind of going nowhere. I was getting really frustrated. And this story came to me. And I knew it was going to be a story with a lot of sadness, a lot of struggle. But I also really wanted it to be a story about people trying to do right by one another, by people trying to come near to one another as much as they could. And that's sometimes not an easy story. It can be very hard to do the right thing, to make that choice that helps someone else. And so I wanted to write a story where people were trying to do that, not always succeeding, but attempting to do that.
I also think, you know, I grew up in Montana. I knew a lot of kids that grew up in small towns. And I think that's even more difficult, I think, when you grow up in a small town where there's less number of people, less variety of people, should we say? And
yeah.
I think one of the stories or one of the themes is people of different persuasions, people of different ages, people from different backgrounds, figuring out how to come together or how to meet.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the main characters here, Justin, is a young kid who's got long blonde hair. He wears earrings in both ears and baggy jeans with holes in them. And he ends up out on the Montana prairie in 1994. And that's just not a place where you would expect to meet a kid like him. And part of that for me was my own growing up. My grandfather grew up around eastern Montana and kind of fit this place. He was a real cowboy. And I remember going off to college and meeting other young folks whose grandpas weren't cowboys and thinking, huh, I thought they were all cowboys. I just thought that was the form grandpas took. He fit this place so well. He loved the work. He loved everything about it. And I showed up, this grandson of his who took after my bookish mom a little bit more. And while I enjoyed the landscape and it mattered a great deal to me, I was never very good on a horse and just a passable hand out on the ranch. And yet he saw me. He saw me for who I was and he accepted me and he believed in me even so. And so that example is, again, one of the things I was trying to capture here is that when Justin's out on that prairie, he ends up running into this old rancher, Rene Bouchard, who despite so many differences, looks at him and sees him and thinks, hold on, I can be open to this kid and I can try to be there for him.
Last night at the reading, I thought you also said that there was a kid very much like Justin that showed up in your high school when you were going to school.
Yes, absolutely. He actually never made it to high school. He showed up one summer when I was working at the county school. I was an assistant janitor. And it was a lot of scraping gum off to the undersides of things. This is after my father had died and we had leased out our acres. And so I needed another job. So that was the job I got. And this kid showed up who was working with me. And he was kind of a shirt-tail relative of a family in town. And I never got all the intricacies of the story, but he had long blonde hair and he wore flannels and he would bring his guitar to work. And at lunch, he'd play acoustic Nirvana tunes. And that music mattered immensely to me at the time, and it mattered to him. And he was from Seattle originally. And I just, we were, in the way of young men, instantly best friends. And we'd made plans for him to stay, and he was maybe even going to stay at our house. And then one day he didn't show up for work. This was in August, and he didn't show up for work again the next day. And I drove out into the Bull Mountains where he stayed and kind of got, again, little bits of the story, but it sounds like he got crossways of, I believe, his uncle who he was staying with, and his uncle put him on a bus back to Seattle. And so his story has been with me. His story in my own life was one of lostness. And so part of the impetus here with The Entire Sky was to try to find him again, to see if I could tell that story of him being found instead of being lost.
Oh, I love that. That's so beautiful. For our listeners, give us a flavor of that time frame. So this young kid from Seattle shows up. He's had a tough life in Seattle. It's a runaway. But there's so much about the time period and the music that you put into the book. Is that from your exact time frame in high school?
Yeah, absolutely. 1994, I was in the middle of my high school years, and I remember really vividly hearing Nirvana and Pearl Jam for the first time. Like many young people, I tried lots of music. I tried listening to hip-hop for a while, and I tried country music, and I tried sort of the more classic rock, and I liked a lot of it, but none of it, I don't know, really fit. And then hearing Nirvana and Pearl Jam, suddenly I was like, oh, this is it. This is the stuff. And it mattered to me because they were taking it so seriously, and it was musically really interesting. And the lyrics, for the most part, were really good. And I listen to it now, and it still holds up. It's still really good music. I also think the example of many of the lead singers was important. Kurt Cobain, Eddie Vedder, Chris Cornell. These were guys who were clearly cool. They were guys, dudes. But they wore their hair long, and they were had earrings, and they stood up for political causes that were things that began to matter to me as well. And so they were just this other example of a way to be a man. And that also mattered to me a great deal.
I love that story. Knowing that that child, that young boy, is moving from that world, from a city, out into a rural environment, and who does he meet but the classic rancher, the farmer, the grandfather?
Yeah.
And clearly, that was somewhat based on your own grandfather. Tell us a little bit more about Renee as the main character.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think that allowed my own grandfather to see me and my brother, who was a lot like me, and see us wholly and truly, was the fact that he'd raised three sons. And I think he'd done a very good job with them, but he also had, and I think he would have admitted this as well, screwed up a time or two. And he had this second chance with his grandsons who lived so close to him. And when our father died, he became our father in many ways. And so Rene Bouchard has the same thing here. He's has three sons, and he's done some things well, and he's not done some things very well with his own sons. And he's really struggling with that, struggling with his own actions and his own inactions, his own inability to see them. And then when this kid walks up, he has this second chance. And it's even though he might not articulate it to himself as that, he feels it inside. Oh, this is a chance again to see a kid and try to see him for who he is.
That is so wonderful. The second chance. I mean, how few of us have the second chance? And he didn't know really that he was not doing the right thing when he was raising his children. And then, unfortunately, something terrible happened.
Yeah.
So this young boy shows up, and I don't know that he initially even understands what he's feeling.
No.
Is that true?
I don't think so either. And in some ways, Justin is also what Renee needs. Renee has kind of come out to the ranch in his own mind for the last time.
He's a curmudgeon.
He's a curmudgeon. He sort of just wanted to turn his back on everything. And then in a lot of ways, Justin brings him out as well and allows him to access the better parts of himself, just as he helps Justin do the same. And so though they shouldn't fit, they do. They become for each other a way to re-enter the world and to keep moving through the world.
There is a certain solitude of the prairie as opposed to living in the city. Joe, I'm wondering about you as a writer growing up in a small rural community in Montana, and now you're teaching. Was that distance important for you in terms of your own writing?
Absolutely. We were just back in my hometown a couple of weeks ago, and we had the great chance to stay at the old homesteader's cabin I used to live in when I worked out in the Bull Mountains on a ranch during the summer, the Meredith Ranch. And my whole family was with me, and my teenage daughter was standing on the porch of the old homestead and looking out, and it's a sweeping view of the bulls, and the sun was going down, and she said, "Dad, I understand why you're a writer. There's so much room to imagine out here." And I think she's right. There is room for the imagination. There's room for you to fill it up. And you also get a sense of your own relationship to distance and absence and great things coming at you from a long ways away. You can see the thunderstorms from so far off. And so it was a wonderful place for me to begin the journey that would lead me to the page.
You mentioned last night that when you first started high school and college, you thought all the great writers were English, and that to discover Jim Welch and some Montana writers that actually were great writers writing about the landscape in Montana was a big surprise for you.
Absolutely. I really had this idea that all the books had been written, and now we just checked them out from the library and read them, which I was happy to do. I loved to read. But when I took a creative writing class in my senior year of college and discovered James Welch, and I discovered Richard Hugo, and they were writing about places I knew and about small towns that felt familiar to me and experiences that felt familiar to me. And I suddenly thought, oh, hold on. This is also, not only is there new work being put into the world, but they're writing about things that I know about. And that was a great permission for me to try to write about my own experience.
Let's hear a little bit more about young Justin, the character. Mm-hmm. So here's the city kid that shows up on the ranch. Do you have a section that you could read that gives us sort of a flavor of what he's like and the circumstance that he's thrown into?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to read a section from, he shows up out at the Bouchard Ranch. He's wandering. He's taking a wrong turn. He's not sure where he is. And he runs into Rene Bouchard, and it's lambing season. And so Rene, of course, puts him to work out in the lambing shed. And again, it seems in the beginning like Justin is a little bit horrified and thinks, what is going on here? This isn't anything I should be involved in. But very quickly, he takes to it. It matters to him. And I think about it now and I think, yeah, of course, lambing is birth and death and all those important things. And Justin dives right in. And so I'm going to read a short section from after they've kind of wrestled a recalcitrant ewe into the shed. She's showing signs of birthing and doesn't want to do what she should do. She's young and skittish. And so they've got the lamb delivered and they've got her in a jug, but she's still not quite doing what she should. Mr. Bouchard wiped his own face with a red handkerchief. Beneath his cowboy hat, those blue-silver eyes of his were shadowed, tired. "You did good work, kid, that's sure, but we'll have to see about this one." As if on cue, the ewe butted the jug door and made a dry, strangled sound in the back of her throat. "She's got to clean that lamb, got to feed it. We'll give her some time, but if she hasn't mothered it in a couple of hours, we'll have to bum it." "What does that mean?" "Means we'll jug the lamb up on its own and put a heat lamp over it and feed it formula ourselves off a pop bottle with a rubber nipple. It'd be a bum lamb then, one without a mother. But it's got a mother. It don't if its mother won't mother it." The old man lowered a pail of water into the jug. The ewe plunged her nose in and drank. She lifted her head and blatted once more, water running off her hairy jaws. Justin was suddenly all kinds of pissed off. After all that, she wasn't even going to mother her own lamb. In the other jugs, new lambs were prancing and kicking, nursing furiously with their long tails shaking and dancing. Justin gripped the wood rail. "That sucks. Doesn't happen often. Most of the bum lambs make it, even if they tend towards scrawny. Still sucks. I know." They washed up and fed and watered the other ewes and lambs. To his chest, Justin held the lambs from this morning, the loose, delicate warmth of them, that rich, fleshy smell. Mr. Bouchard patent-branded each one and the ewes as well. Once they were done, Justin checked the far jug once more. He silently willed the young ewe to do what she ought. "Go on," he told her. "It's what you're supposed to do. It's not even that hard." The old man came up beside him. He was rolling his shirt sleeves back down and buttoning the cuffs. He put a hand to the boy's shoulder, and beneath Justin's anger at the ewe, his wish that she'd mother that lamb, with the other part of him, the part that worked always underneath, reckoning and readying, he was tallying every touch. The first when Mr. Bouchard handed him the penlight in the shed, a few accidental brushings at the table, doing dishes, unloading hay. Then this morning, the old man had squeezed his shoulder before he handed him the truck keys, and now here in the shadow, straw and banded light of the shed, he'd done the same. That wide hand, the strength of it, the coolness. Just moved back through the moments, slowly, carefully, and yes, it was true. Not a one of them had made him uneasy, as so many others had, as his uncle's touch always had. The ewe turned once more, banging against the boards, but then dropped her head and nosed the lamb. "That ain't a bad sign," the old man said, lifting his hand from Justin's shoulder and turning to leave the shed. "Ain't a bad sign at all." They strode the length of the empty shed, the yearling blatting once, twice. Justin looked back each time, hoping. Mr. Bouchard kicked at the sparse straw on the shed floor. "We'll need to spread new straw soon." Justin swallowed. Despite how much he'd slept the past two nights, he was suddenly exhausted. "Do we do that now?" he asked. The old man pulled his hat from his head and rubbed at his eyes, scratched at the stubble on his cheeks and jaw. "No, we'll likely be up tonight with more lambs. We got to reserve our strength. I believe it's about nap time now." "Serious?" "Yep." Justin couldn't help but grin. As tired as he'd been a moment ago, the news that he could do what he wanted to do, lie down on that bed and close his eyes, had him wide awake again. He hoped he could even fall asleep. "Wow, how long does lambing last? I didn't know this was a thing people did. Did your kids like lambing?" "Lambing. It's something, huh? Wow."
I can't help but remember taking Allen Ginsberg out to Jack and Susan Heinemann's ranch. And, of course, here's this little Jewish poet who'd never been around actual lambs or sheep. And he was just horrified that there were such things as bum lamb, because his whole philosophy was like William Blake and lambs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he could not understand why they tied rubber bands around the tails. I mean, there was like a whole different world.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's some of, I mean, Justin's coming from this, you know, not the same place, but from a similar space that's so far away from lambing. And so the intricacies of it, the strangeness of it, it's both a little terrifying to him, but also then delightful. He falls into it.
It becomes a salvation for him.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting for this boy is Rene gives him responsibility.
Yes.
Which he has always been running from, this horrible life. And all of a sudden, he has a job and somebody is depending on him.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I have a 16-year-old son, and when he was in middle school, coached his basketball team. And young men want responsibility. They want someone to look at them and say, that's your part to take care of, and you need to do it well. And that's a kindness to them, and it's something that Justin has not had the chance to have, someone to look at him and say, this is your part. You need to do this. And it can, of course, become overbearing, but and it's probably hard to get that balance right. I know it's hard to get that balance right. But Justin needs that. He needs to be looked at and thought of as capable, and he can offer something back, not just take things, but offer something back. And I think young men in our society absolutely need that. And I think we have a bit of a crisis of boys in this world. And part of it stems from we haven't given them enough real things to do.
Joe, this is your second novel.
Yes.
Correct? Mm-hmm. I first knew your work, essays. I think mm-hmm, your first mm-hmm. book was a collection of essays. You've written several books of poetry. For writers, how do you make that decision? What becomes a story? How does something become a poem? And then where does the novel fall in that line of the work that you're doing?
Yeah. As a young writer, I don't think I really knew. It was sort of like trying to just hold on to the fire hose, and it was, you know, going everywhere. And so often I would try things out in various forms. I've gotten to the point now where when language is what matters to me most. When I'm just interested in playing around with it, seeing what it can do, things start to become a poem. And when I have a question or a thing I can't answer that is rooted in my own life, that becomes an essay. Something I've seen, something I've experienced, an idea I'm sort of wrestling with in my own mind, that becomes an essay. And then for the stories, it's very much about seeing something and just beginning to ask what if, or beginning to follow that next line. And again, for this, it was thinking about this boy, this Justin, and thinking, what if someone found him? And then who would find him and what would happen? And knowing that was where I was sort of headed with this. And I've, you know, written another novel, and I've been working on a number of short stories, and that's often where it begins, is a character and then thinking, what if this happens, or what if they choose this or do this, and then let's just see where it goes next.
I can't help but think having raised your own children probably has had a big influence on what you write.
Yes, absolutely. Almost all the essays, the nonfiction, comes out of my experience being a parent now, because those are the big important questions in my mind. And they show up in the poems a lot, too. And increasingly, that experience is showing up in the fiction, though in very different ways. I've been working on a new short story set in the Coast Range, kind of, we call it our home river, the Nestucca River. It's just a Coast Range river that runs out to Pacific City and beautiful country. But it's also a well-used country. 100 years ago, it was nearly all clear-cut. There's a lot of poverty back in the Coast Range and small towns that were former lumber towns that are struggling. And so you'll see things when we go out there camping. You'll see people camping there who've been there for weeks at a time because that's where they need to live now. There was a moment we were playing in the river when the kids were a couple years younger, and there was a girl there, roughly my daughter's age, who I could just tell was coming from a very different experience. And of course, on the river, they can share that space and play and be together. And so the story, River Girl, Town Girl, is sort of falling out of that moment, just seeing them play there.
It's a new landscape for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very interesting coming from eastern Montana, and now you're in...
Yeah, I went from the big dry to the big wet. It's very different.
Joe, who were the writers that influenced you? And also, who are you reading now?
Yeah, I can say for this book in particular, The Entire Sky, Kit Haraf was in my mind a lot. His book, Plain Song, is just one of the books I hold closest to my heart. It matters to me immensely. And so thinking about what care he takes with his characters, what care he takes with the community that he builds, was something that I wanted to try to do in this book. Right now, I'm always reading a lot of things. I just finished Jess Walter's new novel, So Far Gone, and he's so funny and so sharp. And talk about someone, too, who sees the strange ways we might end up in community with each other. He's so good at that. I'm reading a book by Jamie Gordon called Lord of Misrule right now, and it's a wonderful novel for voice. It's all these characters sort of set around this horse race track, and it's so different from something I would write, but I love what she's doing with how these various characters are speaking into this same story.
I also have to ask, what are you teaching?
Yeah, I teach mostly creative writing and first-year writing at Linfield University. Right now I'm teaching our inquiry seminar class, which is our first-year writing class, and it's themed, and professors from across campus teach it. And the one I'm teaching is called Rural America and Contemporary Literature, Film, and Song. And in that class, so we listen to a lot of music, a lot of country music, and we watch Reservation Dogs and Cowboys, the film, and then we read Bonnie Jo Campbell and Benjamin Percy and Nina McConaughey and all these great writers writing about rural spaces and small towns. And it's a wonderful class for students to sort of see a part of the world that they sort of have quickly looked at and usually thought of in somewhat stereotypical a vision of it. And this suddenly they have to reorient themselves. And then in so doing, then they have to think, oh, hold on, now I have to look at the other parts of the world and reorient my own stereotypes there too. And so that's kind of the project of the class. And I'm also teaching our thesis class, which is a year-long thesis, and we say our students are writing a near book-length work of creative stuff, whether it's a novella or a memoir or a collection of poems. And they're really excited right now and have lots of great ideas, and they're just beginning. And I know in about 3 months they're going to be tearing their hair out and worried that they're going to finish. But
we're talking with Joe Wilkins, whose new novel, The Entire Sky, just published recently. It is a nominated book for Best Fiction for the High Plains Book Award. I guess I don't know. I've read the book. I don't know what the title means.
Yeah, so I can't seem to start with it. So the working title was All Apologies, after the Nirvana song, which features in the book. And it was a good working title, but my editor said right away, we're going to have to change it. And that was my experience with the last novel, too. In the last novel, I had a working title on it, and he said, it sounds too much like a book of poems. I thought, oh, fair enough. That's where I'm coming from, so you probably got that right. And so in both cases, my editor had me just go back through the book, and he was like, go back through the book, find some moments or find some language that speak to you. Give me a list of five or six. And in both cases, I went through and found some language, and I remember thinking, oh, that's the one, and sent them to him, and he picked the same one. And so for me, The Entire Sky is a line that shows up a couple times. And in one instance, it's a moment when one of the characters, Leanne Bouchard, Renee's grown daughter, is sort of reckoning with her own losses and her own choices, and she feels this huge Montana sky just sort of fall onto her shoulders, and she feels this great weight. And it's not a good thing. It's a thing she thinks she can't get out from under. And then later in the novel, she has a similar experience where she drives up onto a hill and she looks up and she feels the sky moving up above her and that weight suddenly lifting. And so the entire sky becomes this realm of possibility as much as responsibility.
It is so much about Eastern Montana. When I think of The Entire Sky, I think of people that have come to Montana, and it's frightening. It's overwhelming to see that much space and sky and not much else.
Yeah.
So it can become sort of oppressive and lonely, but then also it can open up to all the possibilities that are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad was actually from North Carolina, and so when he married my mom and came back to her family's ranch, his mom from North Carolina came out, and one of his sisters then, when she came back, asked her about it, and she said, well, it's a nice place to visit, but I can't imagine anyone could live there. And I think it was partly that, a little bit of terror at these wide vistas and this huge hunk of sky that you could see. And I do think that there can be that reaction to it. I know growing up there, I have a very different reaction. I remember going back east for the first time and thinking, I really want to get a look at the landscape, but all these trees are in the way. I can't see anything.
Joe, thank you so much. I will encourage all of our listeners to pick up Joe's new novel, The Entire Sky. We'll have more information on the website about the book and about Joe. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Corby. This has been really fun.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.